Chapter 8. Distant Precedent and the Saga of Purim. Ritual murder accusations have been made against the Jews for thousands of years. The murders were sometimes alleged to have been accompanied by ritual cannibalism, but not always. In every case, it is rather improbable that the testimonies which have come down to us from antiquity were known and disseminated in the Middle Ages and could constitute a significant point of reference for later accusations of crucifixion and ritual cannibalism. As early as the 2nd century before Christ, the almost unknown Greek historian, Democritus, who probably lived in Alexandria, recorded a violently biased anti-Jewish testimony, at that time referred to under his name in Suidas' Greek dictionary. According to Democritus, the Jews were accustomed to render worship to a golden head of an ass. Every 7 years, they abducted a foreigner to sacrifice him, tearing the body to pieces. This horrible rite is said to have taken place probably every 7 years in the Temple of Jerusalem, sanctuary of the Jewish religion. Democritus' report is evidently intended to stress the barbarism of the Jews, the haters of mankind, who practiced superstitious and cruel cults. It should nevertheless be noted that the Greek historian made no reference either to any need to collect the victim's blood or other forms of ritual cannibalism. A report only partly similar to that reported by Democritus is found in the polemical Contra Apiani, by Flavius Josephus, quoting the tendentiously anti-Jewish rhetorician, Apiani, who lived at Alexandria during the 1st century of the Christian era. According to Apiani, Antiochus Epiphane, entering the Temple of Jerusalem, is said to have been surprised to find a Greek, stretched on a bed and surrounded by exquisite foods and rich dishes. The prisoner's report was extraordinary and horrifying. The Greek said that he had been captured by the Jews and taken to the temple and concealed from everyone, while they force-fed him on all sorts of foods. At first, it the unusual circumstances in which he found himself did not greatly displease him until the sanctuary attendants revealed the fate waiting in store for him. He was fated to die, the predestined victim of homicidal Jewish sacrificial practices. The Jews carry out this rite every year, on a pre-established date. They catch a Greek merchant and feed him for a whole year. They later take him into a forest, kill him and sacrifice him according to their religion. They then savor the viscera, and in the moment of sacrificing the Greek, they swear their hatred of all Greeks. They then dump the remains of the carcass into a ditch. Flavius Josephus reports that the history recounted by Apiani was not invented by him, but was, rather, derived from other Greek writers, an indication that its dissemination must have been much more widespread than we are led to imagine based on the two only surviving accounts, that is, of Democritus and Apion. Compared to the first, the second describes a number of variants which are undoubtedly important. The sacrificial ceremony is now annual, and held on a fixed date, even if the account does not specify the Jewish holiday on which it allegedly took place. Furthermore, ritual cannibalism is now stressed in an explicit and brutal manner, even if there is still no mention of any need for human blood, which, as we have seen, is said to have become the preponderant element starting with the Middle Ages. On the other hand, that both Greeks and Romans are alleged to have ended up as a meal for ravenous Jews is shown by the fact that Dio Cassius, writing of their rebellion at Cyrene, 115 of the Christian era, hastened to mention, in disgust, that the Jews were accustomed to feasting upon the bodies of Greek and Roman enemies slain in battle. Not contenting themselves with the satisfaction of this alimentary predilection, they painted their bodies with the blood of their enemies and used their intestines as belts. A more delicate matter than the above seems to relate to a passage in the Talmud, Ketubot 102b, which might be interpreted as an indirect confirmation of the phenomenon of ritual and murder during an ancient epoch, although we don't know how widespread or how widely approved it may have been. The passage concerns a so-called outside Baraita, or Mishnah, that is, one not incorporated into the codified and canonical text of the Mishnah dating back approximately to the 3rd century AD, which seems to be one of the oldest, and may therefore be traced back to Palestine at the time of the Second Temple. A man is killed, leaving a son of a tender age in the care of his mother. When the father's heirs approach and say, "Let him grow up with us," and the mother says, "Let him grow up with me," he, the boy, should be left with the mother, and should not be entrusted to the care of anyone entitled to inherit from him. A case of this kind happened in the past, and the heirs killed him on Passover Eve, Hebrew, Meshechachahuariv Harpisach. We know that the Hebrew verb sheshe has the meaning of butcher, kill, as well as to immolate, as, for example, as a sacrifice, as for example, Exodus 12:21, "Thou shalt sacrifice the Passover lamb, Wishechachu Harpisach." If in the case in question were merely a matter of a simple murder committed by heirs for profit, the statement that the murder was committed on Passover Eve would be quite superfluous. In fact, in support of the law providing that the child should be entrusted to the mother instead of persons entitled to inherit his property, it would have been sufficient merely to state that, in the past, a child had been killed by his heirs. When and how the murder occurred is in fact superfluous, except to remind the reader of a case, which was presumably well known, in which such a child murder, which deserved to be condemned, actually occurred, but only for material and egotistical motives. At this point, it might be noted that the most ancient Christian authors appeared to make no use of this Talmudic passage in their anti-Jewish polemics, although the passage shows a relationship between the cruel killing of a child and the Jewish Passover, which might have been used by them in support of the ritual murder accusation. But perhaps their failure to do so was due to poor knowledge of Talmudic literature and rabbinical literature in general on the part of Christian polemicists, who were often ignorant of Talmudic and rabbinical language and interpretive categories. Be that as it may, it is advisable to stress that the reading "they killed or immolated him on Passover Eve, Wishechachahu Ariv Harpisach," appears in all the manuscript and ancient versions of the Ketubot treatise in question, as well as in the first edition of the Talmud, printed at Venice in 1521 by Daniel Bamberg. Later, no doubt for the purpose of defending themselves against the ritual murder accusation brought by those who had, in the meantime, discovered the potential value of the embarrassing passage, the Jewish editors of the Talmud replaced the passage with a more anemic, less embarrassing reading: "They killed him on New Year's Eve, Ariv Rosh Hashanah," or "They killed him the first evening, Ariv Harishon." The latter version might suggest that the child's heirs got rid of him in a violent way as early as the evening of the day upon which he was entrusted to them, with the obvious intention of getting their hands on the estate as soon as possible. the editors of the famous Vilna edition of the Talmud, 1835, justified their decision to adopt the reading. They killed him the first evening in a glossa to Keterbot 102b, in which they rejected the preceding version, but without explicitly mentioning it, containing a reference to Passover Eve, as the circumstance under which the unhappy child is said to have been cruelly killed. Whoever preceded us in the Talmud, they stressed, fell into error and preferred a reading completely torn out of context. That Christian Europe of the Middle Ages feared the Jews is an established fact. Perhaps the widespread fear that Jews were scheming to abduct children, subjecting them to cruel rituals, even antedates the appearance of stereotypical ritual murder, which seems to have originated in the 12th century. As for myself, I believe that serious consideration should be given to the possibility that this fear was largely related to the slave trade, particularly in the 9th and 10th centuries, when the Jewish role in the slave trade appears to have been preponderant. During this period, Jewish merchants from the cities in the valley of the Rhone, Verdun, Ligny, Ars and Narbonne, in addition to Aquisgrana, the capital of the empire in the times of Louis the Pious, Louis I, and, in Germany, from the centers of the valley of the Rhine, from Worms, Magenta and Magdeburg, in Bavaria and Bohemia, from Regensburg and Prague, were active in the principal markets in which slaves, women, men, eunuchs were offered for sale by Jews, sometimes after abducting them from their houses. From Christian Europe, the human merchandise was exported to the Islamic lands of Spain, in which there was a lively market. The castration of these slaves, particularly children, raised their prices and was no doubt a lucrative and profitable practice. The first testimony relating to the abduction of children by Jewish merchants active in the trade flowing into Arab Spain comes down to us in a letter from Argobard, Archbishop of Lyon, in the years 816-840. The French prelate describes the appearance at Lyon of a Christian slave, having escaped from Cordoba, who had been abducted from a Lyonese Jewish merchant 24 years before, when he was a child, to be sold to the Muslims of Spain. His companion in flight was another Christian slave, having suffered a similar fate after being abducted 6 years before by Jewish merchants at Arles. The inhabitants of Lyons confirmed these claims, adding that yet another Christian boy had been abducted by Jews to be sold into slavery that same year. Argobard concludes his report with a comment of a general nature, that these were not considered isolated cases, because, in everyday practice, the Jews continued to procure Christian slaves for themselves and furthermore subjecting them to infamies such that it would be vile in itself to describe them. Precisely what kind of abominable infamies Argobard is referring to is not clear, but it is possible that he was referring to castration more than to circumcision. Liot Prando, Bishop of Cremona, in his Antarpadosis, said to have been written in approximately 958-962, referred to the city of Verdun as the principal market in which Jews castrated young slaves intended for sale to the Muslims of Spain. During this same period, two Arab sources, Ibn Hawqal and Ibrahim al-Qarawi, also stressed that the majority of their eunuchs originated from France and were sold to the Iberian Peninsula by Jewish merchants. Other Arabic writers mentioned Lucerna, a city with a Jewish majority, halfway between Cordoba and Malaga in southern Spain, as another major market, in which the castration of Christian children after reducing them to slavery was practiced on a large scale by the very same people. Contemporary rabbinical responses provide further confirmation of the role played by Jews in the trade in children and young people, as well as in the profitable transformation of boys into eunuchs. These texts reveal that anyone who engaged in such trade was aware of the risks involved, because any person caught and arrested in possession of castrated slaves in Christian territories was decapitated by order of the local authorities. Even the famous Natronae, Jayan of the Rabbinical College of Sura in the mid-9th century was aware of the problems linked to the dangerous trade in young eunuchs. Jewish merchants entered into a port or a city, bringing with them slaves and castrated children. Hebrew, Sarissim Kitanim. When the local authorities confiscated them, the Jews corrupted them with money, reducing them to more harmless advisers, and the merchandise was returned, at least in part. But if one wishes to interpret the significance and scope of the Jewish presence in the slave trade and practice of castration, it is a fact that the fear that Christian children might be abducted and sold was rather widespread and deeply rooted in all Western European countries, particularly France and Germany, from which these Jews originated and where the greater part of the slave merchants operated. Personalities in the clergy nourished that fear, conferring religious connotations upon it with an anti-Jewish slant, failing to account for the fact that slavery as a trade had not yet gone out of fashion morally and, as such, was broadly tolerated in the economic reality of the period. On the other hand, the abduction and castration of children, often inevitably confused with circumcision, which was no less feared and abhorred, could not fail to insinuate themselves in the collective unconscious mind of Christian Europe, especially the French and German territories, inciting anxiety and fear, probably solidified over time, believed, as a result, to have concretized itself, in a variety of ways and in more or less in the same places, as ritual and murder. In the Hebrew calendar, Pesach, Passover, comes 1 month after the Feast of Purim, which commemorates the miraculous salvation of the Jewish people in Persia during the reign of King Ahasuerus I 519-465, from the threat of extermination linked to the plotting of the king's perfidious minister, Haman. The Book of Esther, which examines all these explosive matters and exalts the saving function of the biblical heroine as well as that of Mordecai, Esther's uncle and mentor, concludes with the hanging of Haman and his 10 sons, as well as with the beneficial massacre of the enemies of Israel. Liam de Medina in his T, describes Purim in precisely this manner, stressing a carnival-like atmosphere of celebrations and convivial opulence in which restraint and inhibition were dangerously weakened. On the 14th of Adar, which is March, is the festival of Purim, in memory of everything we read in the Book of Esther, which saved the people of Israel from being exterminated through the machinations of Haman, and he and his sons were hanged. After the ordinary orations, with remembrance only of the escape which occurred at the hour of death, we read the entire history or Book of Esther, written in bulk, on parchment, like the Pentateuch, and which we call Megillah, that is, volume. And some hearing Haman's name mentioned, pound on the tables as a sign to curse him. They make much rejoicing festivities and banquets. An effort is made to serve the most sumptuous meal possible and eat and drink more than usual, after which friends go out to visit each other, with receptions, festivities and revelry. For a number of reasons, not least that of its not infrequent proximity to Holy Week, Purim, also called the Festival of the Lots, came, in time, to acquire openly anti-Christian connotations and the related celebrations became openly suggestive in the Chapter 8. Distant Precedents and the Saga of Purim. Ritual murder accusations have been made against the Jews for thousands of years. The murders were sometimes alleged to have been accompanied by ritual cannibalism, but not always. In every case, it is rather improbable that the testimonies which have come down to us from antiquity were known and disseminated in the Middle Ages and could constitute a significant point of reference for later accusations of crucifixion and ritual cannibalism. As early as the 2nd century before Christ, the almost unknown Greek historian, Democritus, who probably lived in Alexandria, recorded a violently biased anti-Jewish testimony, at that time referred to under his name in Suidas' Greek dictionary. According to Democritus, the Jews were accustomed to render worship to a golden head of an ass. Every 7 years, they abducted a foreigner to sacrifice him, tearing the body to pieces. This horrible rite is said to have taken place probably every 7 years in the Temple of Jerusalem, sanctuary of the Jewish religion. Democritus' report is evidently intended to stress the barbarism of the Jews, the haters of mankind, who practiced superstitious and cruel cults. It should nevertheless be noted that the Greek historian made no reference either to any need to collect the victim's blood or other forms of ritual cannibalism. A report only partly similar to that reported by Democritus is found in the polemical Contra Apiani, by Flavius Josephus, quoting the tendentiously anti-Jewish rhetorician, Apiani, who lived at Alexandria during the 1st century of the Christian era. According to Apiani, Antiochus Epiphane, entering the Temple of Jerusalem, is said to have been surprised to find a Greek, stretched on a bed and surrounded by exquisite foods and rich dishes. The prisoner's report was extraordinary and horrifying. The Greek said that he had been captured by the Jews and taken to the temple and concealed from everyone, while they force-fed him on all sorts of foods. At first, it the unusual circumstances in which he found himself did not greatly displease him until the sanctuary attendants revealed the fate waiting in store for him. He was fated to die, the predestined victim of homicidal Jewish sacrificial practices. The Jews carry out this rite every year, on a pre-established date. They catch a Greek merchant and feed him for a whole year. They later take him into a forest, kill him and sacrifice him according to their religion. They then savor the viscera, and in the moment of sacrificing the Greek, they swear their hatred of all Greeks. They then dump the remains of the carcass into a ditch. Flavius Josephus reports that the history recounted by Apiani was not invented by him, but was, rather, derived from other Greek writers, an indication that its dissemination must have been much more widespread than we are led to imagine based on the two only surviving accounts, that is, of Democritus and Apion. Compared to the first, the second describes a number of variants which are undoubtedly important. The sacrificial ceremony is now annual, and held on a fixed date, even if the account does not specify the Jewish holiday on which it allegedly took place. Furthermore, Ritual cannibalism is now stressed in an explicit and brutal manner, even if there is still no mention of any need for human blood, which, as we have seen, is said to have become the preponderant element starting with the Middle Ages. On the other hand, that both Greeks and Romans are alleged to have ended up as a meal for ravenous Jews is shown by the fact that Dio Cassius, writing of their rebellion at Cyrene, 115 of the Christian era, hastened to mention, in disgust, that the Jews were accustomed to feasting upon the bodies of Greek and Roman enemies slain in battle. Not contenting themselves with the satisfaction of this alimentary predilection, they painted their bodies with the blood of their enemies and used their intestines as belts. A more delicate matter than the above seems to relate to a passage in the Talmud, Ketubot 102b, which might be interpreted as an indirect confirmation of the phenomenon of ritual and murder during an ancient epoch, although we don't know how widespread or how widely approved it may have been. The passage concerns a so-called outside baratah, or mishnah, that is, one not incorporated into the codified and canonical text of the Mishnah dating back approximately to the 3rd century AD, which seems to be one of the oldest, and may therefore be traced back to Palestine at the time of the Second Temple. A man is killed, leaving a son of a tender age in the care of his mother. When the father's heirs approach and say, "Let him grow up with us," and the mother says, "Let him grow up with me," he, the boy, should be left with the mother, and should not be entrusted to the care of anyone entitled to inherit from him. A case of this kind happened in the past and the heirs killed him on Passover Eve, Hebrew, Eve Harpisach. We know that the Hebrew verb sheshe has the meaning of butcher, kill, as well as to immolate, as, for example, as a sacrifice, as for example, Exodus 12:21, "Thou shalt sacrifice the Passover lamb, Vishachachu Harpisach." If in the case in question were merely a matter of a simple murder committed by heirs for profit, the statement that the murder was committed on Passover Eve would be quite superfluous. In fact, in support of the law providing that the child should be entrusted to the mother instead of persons entitled to inherit his property, it would have been sufficient merely to state that, in the past, a child had been killed by his heirs. When and how the murder occurred is in fact superfluous, except to remind the reader of a case, which was presumably well known, in which such a child murder, which deserved to be condemned, actually occurred, but only for material and egotistical motives. At this point, it might be noted that the most ancient Christian authors appeared to make no use of this Talmudic passage in their anti-Jewish polemics, although the passage shows a relationship between the cruel killing of a child and the Jewish Passover, which might have been used by them in support of the ritual murder accusation. But perhaps their failure to do so was due to poor knowledge of Talmudic literature and rabbinical literature in general on the part of Christian polemicists, who were often ignorant of Talmudic and rabbinical language and interpretive categories. Be that as it may, it is advisable to stress that the reading "they killed or immolated him on Passover Eve, Vishachachahu Ariv Harpisach," appears in all the manuscript and ancient versions of the Ketubot treatise in question, as well as in the first edition of the Talmud, printed at Venice in 1521 by Daniel Bamberg. Later, no doubt for the purpose of defending themselves against the ritual murder accusation brought by those who had, in the meantime, discovered the potential value of the embarrassing passage, The Jewish editors of the Talmud replaced the passage with a more anemic, less embarrassing reading: they killed him on New Year's Eve, Ariv Rosh Hashanah, or they killed him the first evening, Ariv HaRishon. The latter version might suggest that the child's heirs got rid of him in a violent way as early as the evening of the day upon which he was entrusted to them, with the obvious intention of getting their hands on the estate as soon as possible. The editors of the famous Vilna edition of the Talmud, 1835, justified their decision to adopt the reading "they killed him the first evening" in a glossary to Ketubot 102b, in which they rejected the preceding version, but without explicitly mentioning it, containing a reference to Passover Eve, as the circumstance under which the unhappy child is said to have been cruelly killed. Whoever preceded us in the Talmud, they stressed, fell into error and preferred a reading completely torn out of context. That Christian Europe of the Middle Ages feared the Jews is an established fact. Perhaps the widespread fear that Jews were scheming to abduct children, subjecting them to cruel rituals, even antedates the appearance of stereotypical ritual murder which seems to have originated in the 12th century. As for myself, I believe that serious consideration should be given to the possibility that this fear was largely related to the slave trade, particularly in the 9th and 10th centuries, when the Jewish role in the slave trade appears to have been preponderant. During this period, Jewish merchants from the cities in the valley of the Rhone, Verdun, Ligny, Ars and Narbonne, in addition to Aquisgrana, the capital of the empire in the times of Louis the Pious, Louis I, and, in Germany, from the centers of the valley of the Rhine, from Worms, Magenta and Magdeburg, in Bavaria and Bohemia, from Regensburg and Prague, were active in the principal markets in which slaves, women, men, eunuchs, were offered for sale by Jews, sometimes after abducting them from their houses. From Christian Europe, the human merchandise was exported to the Islamic lands of Spain, in which there was a lively market. The castration of these slaves, particularly children, raised their prices and was no doubt a lucrative and profitable practice. The first testimony relating to the abduction of children by Jewish merchants active in the trade flowing into Arab Spain comes down to us in a letter from Argobard, Archbishop of Lyon, in the years 816-840. The French prelate describes the appearance at Lyon of a Christian slave, having escaped from Cordoba, who had been abducted from a Lyonese Jewish merchant 24 years before, when he was a child, to be sold to the Muslims of Spain. His companion in flight was another Christian slave having suffered a similar fate after being abducted 6 years before by Jewish merchants at Arles. The inhabitants of Lyons confirmed these claims, adding that yet another Christian boy had been abducted by Jews to be sold into slavery that same year. Argobard concludes his report with a comment of a general nature, that these were not considered isolated cases, because, in everyday practice, the Jews continued to procure Christian slaves for themselves and furthermore subjecting them to infamies such that it would be vile in itself to describe them. Precisely what kind of abominable infamies Argobard is referring to is not clear, but it is possible that he was referring to castration more than to circumcision. Liot Prando, Bishop of Cremona, in his Antarpadosis, said to have been written in approximately 958-962, referred to the city of Verdun as the principal market in which Jews castrated young slaves intended for sale to the Muslims of Spain. During this same period, two Arab sources, Ibn Hawqal and Ibrahim al-Qarawi, also stressed that the majority of their eunuchs originated from France and were sold to the Iberian Peninsula by Jewish merchants. Other Arabic writers mentioned Lucerna, a city with a Jewish majority, halfway between Cordoba and Malaga in southern Spain, as another major market, in which the castration of Christian children after reducing them to slavery was practiced on a large scale by the very same people. Contemporary rabbinical responses provide further confirmation of the role played by Jews in the trade in children and young people, as well as in the profitable transformation of boys into eunuchs. These texts reveal that anyone who engaged in such trade was aware of the risks involved, because any person caught and arrested in possession of castrated slaves in Christian territories was decapitated by order of the local authorities. Even the famous Natronae, Jayan of the Rabbinical College of Sura in the mid-9th century was aware of the problems linked to the dangerous trade in young eunuchs. Jewish merchants entered into a port or a city, bringing with them slaves and castrated children. Hebrew, Sarissim Kitanim. When the local authorities confiscated them, the Jews corrupted them with money, reducing them to more harmless advisers, and the merchandise was returned, at least in part. But if one wishes to interpret the significance and scope of the Jewish presence in the slave trade and practice of castration, it is a fact that the fear that Christian children might be abducted and sold was rather widespread and deeply rooted in all Western European countries, particularly France and Germany, from which these Jews originated and where the greater part of the slave merchants operated. Personalities in the clergy nourished that fear, conferring religious connotations upon it with an anti-Jewish slant, failing to account for the fact that slavery as a trade had not yet gone out of fashion morally and, as such, was broadly tolerated in the economic reality of the period. On the other hand, the abduction and castration of children, often inevitably confused with circumcision, which was no less feared and abhorred, could not fail to insinuate themselves in the collective unconscious mind of Christian Europe, especially the French and German territories, inciting anxiety and fear, probably solidified over time, believed, as a result, to have concretized itself, in a variety of ways and in more or less in the same places, as ritual murder. In the Hebrew calendar, Pesach, Passover, comes 1 month after the Feast of Purim, which commemorates the miraculous salvation of the Jewish people in Persia during the reign of King Ahasuerus I 519-465, from the threat of extermination linked to the plotting of the king's perfidious minister, Haman. The Book of Esther, which examines all these explosive matters and exalts the saving function of the biblical heroine as well as that of Mordecai, Esther's uncle and mentor, concludes with the hanging of Haman and his 10 sons, as well as with the beneficial massacre of the enemies of Israel. Liam de Medina in his T, describes Purim in precisely this manner, stressing a carnival-like atmosphere of celebrations and convivial opulence in which restraint and inhibition were dangerously weakened. On the 14th of Adar, which is March, is the festival of Purim, in memory of everything we read in the Book of Esther, which saved the people of Israel from being exterminated through the machinations of Haman, and he and his sons were hanged. After the ordinary orations, with remembrance only of the escape which occurred at the hour of death, we read the entire history or Book of Esther, written in bulk, on parchment, like the Pentateuch, and which we call Megillah, that is, volume. And some hearing Haman's name mentioned, pound on the tables as a sign to curse him. They make much rejoicing festivities and banquets. An effort is made to serve the most sumptuous meal possible and eat and drink more than usual, after which friends go out to visit each other, with receptions, festivities and revelry. For a number of reasons, not least that of its not infrequent proximity to Holy Week, Purim, also called the Festival of the Lots, came, in time, to acquire openly anti-Christian connotations, and the related celebrations became openly suggestive in this sense, both in form and substance, sometimes audaciously and openly. Haman, equated with that other biblical archenemy of the Jews, Amalek, Deuteronomy 25:17-19, whose memory was to be blotted out from the face of the earth, was transformed, over time, into Jesus, the false Messiah, whose impious followers were now threatening the chosen people with extermination. Moreover, Haman was killed, hanged, as Jesus was said to have been, and there was no shortage of exegetic material reinforcing this paragon. In the Greek translation of the Septuagint, as well as in Flavius Josephus' Antiquities of the Jews, Book 11, pages 267-280, Haman's gallows was interpreted as a cross, and the execution of King Ahasuerus' belligerent minister was described, in effect, as a true and proper crucifixion. The equation between Amalek, Haman and Christ was self-evidently obvious. Haman, who, in the biblical text is referred to as Talua, the hanged one, was confused with him who, in all anti-Christian Hebraic texts, was the Talua by antonymasia, the replacement of a proper name by an epithet, that is, the crucified Christ. The sensational trial of the most prominent members of the Ashkenazi communities of northern Italy accused of vilifying the Christian religion was held in Milan in the spring of 1488. In reply to inquisitors demanding the name used by Jews with reference to Jesus of Nazareth, Salomone de Camo, one of the accused, answered unhesitatingly, "Among ourselves we call him Osoes, that man, from the Hebrew Otto Haish, according to the German pronunciation, or Talua, the hanged one, the crucified one, while, when speaking to Christians, we always refer to him as Christ." It is not surprising that the text by 4th century writer Evagrius describes the Jew Simony, in an argument with a Christian, Theophilus, should have equated the cursed and despised passion of Christ with Haman's crucifixion. According to the great English anthropologist James George Frazer, Christ died while playing the role of Haman, the dying god, in a drama of Purim in which Jesus Barabbas, the double of Jesus of Nazareth, played the part of Mordecai, the god that resurges. In the model of the god that dies and is reborn, which is common in the Near East, Haman is said to have played the part of death and Mordecai that of life, while the celebration of Purim is said to constitute the Hebraic ritual of death and resurrection. Based on this consideration, one might hypothesize that, in the past, the Jews, at the culmination of the festival, might have been accustomed to putting a man to death in flesh and blood reality, and that Jesus was crucified in this context, playing the role of Ahasuerus' tragic minister, the archenemy of Israel. There is no shortage of testimonies of the celebration of rituals within the framework of the Carnival of Purim, intended to vilify and outrage the image of Haman, reconstituted in the semblance of Christ hanging from the cross. First, the Emperor Honorius 384-423 and, in his footsteps, Theodosius 401-450, prohibited the Jews from the provinces of the empire from setting fire to effigies of Haman crucified in contempt of the Christian religion. Probably to be associated with the preceding prohibitions is the report, mentioned by the late chronicler Agapius, 10th century, and dating back to 404-407 AD, during the reign of Theodosius II, Flavius Theodosius, Roman Emperor of the East, 401-450 AD, that certain Jews of Alexandria, forced to submit to baptism, are said to have rebelled, giving a rise to a sensational protest, stating that, in their eyes, such a ceremony possessed the fascination of a certain originality. They are said to have taken an image of the crucified Christ, heaping insults upon the Christians, mocking them with the words, "This is our Messiah." It is not impossible that the episode formed part of the framework of the Hebraic Purim celebrations. Before 1027, at Byzantium Constantinople, now Istanbul, baptized Jews were required to curse their ex-fellow Jews who celebrated the festival of Mordecai, crucifying Haman on a beam of wood, in the form of a cross, and then setting fire to it, accompanying the vile rite with a torrent of imprecations directed at those faithful to Christ. Again, in the very early 13th century, Arnel, prior of the monastery at Lübeck, censured the wickedness of the Jews in bitter terms in crucifying the figure of the Redeemer every year, making him the object of shameless ridicule. Even the Hebrew texts do not seem to be sparing on information in this regard. The Talmudic Dictionary Aruch, consisting of the Rabbi Nathan B. Ehiel of Rome in the second half of the 11th century, contains reports that the Jews of Babylon were accustomed to celebrate the festival of Purim in a particular way. It is the custom among the Jews of Babylon and the rest of the entire world for the boys to make effigies shaped like Haman and hang them on the roofs of their houses for 4 or 5 days before the festival. In the days of Purim, they prepare a phallus and throw it among these images, while they stand around singing songs. The above-mentioned rites were culinary, even symbolically cannibalistic in nature. The effigies of Haman Christ were of sweet pastry, to be destroyed, avidly consumed by youngsters and children during the days of carnival. During the Middle Ages, the sweet delicacy enjoying absolute primacy in the sumptuous banquets of Purim was a typical biscuit, once again bearing the pathetic figure of Haman as a gastronomic butt of ridicule. The so-called Haman's ears on Zaman, presented in a variety of versions according to the various traditions of the Jewish community, gained a position of great importance in the Feast of Purim. In Italy, they were strips of puff pastry shaped like ass ears, fried in olive oil and powdered sugar, which quite resembled the Tuscan sensile and Roman frappe prepared during carnival time. Among Oriental and North African Jews, the puff pastry was roasted and covered with honey and sesame seeds. The Italian Ashkenazim did not much care for the overly Mediterranean taste of these biscuits, which they called galai and frit in contempt. Fried priests, literally people with the tonsure, confirming the detestable relationship between Haman, Israel's bitter enemy, and the arrogance of Christianity, with its priests. Their version of the ears were called hamantaschen or Haman's pockets, and was more elaborate. These consisted of a large triangle-shaped cake of egg pasta filled with a sweet brownish mixture based on poppy seeds. Nor should we be surprised to find that, even in the relatively recent past, there was no shortage of people in Germany who shared the belief, curious even if not very original, that the Ashkenazi stuffed their hamantaschen with the coagulated blood of Christian boys martyred by them. Modern anti-Semites gather and disseminate this cannibalistic fable today from their university chairs, particularly in the Arab countries, making it the subject of ridiculous pseudo-historical research. Turning back centuries, however, we must note, following Fraser, that the ritual of Purim did not always conclude with the bloodless hanging of a mere effigy of Haman. Sometimes, the effigy was a flesh-and-blood Christian, crucified for real, during the wild revelry of the Jewish carnival. One of the available sources in this regard is Socrates' Scholasticus, History of the Church in the 5th century, which, from its Historia Ecclesiastica, Chapter 6, Section 16, refers to a case occurring in 415 at Iomistar, near Antioch, in Syria. The local Hebrews, in their debaucheries and intemperate revelry to celebrate Purim, after getting suitably drunk, according to the prescriptions of the ritual, which provided that they must drink so much wine that they can no longer distinguish Haman from Mordecai, took to deriding the Christians and Christ himself in their boasting. They ridiculed the cross and anyone trusting in the crucifix, putting the following joke in practice. They took a Christian child, tied it to a cross and hanged him. Initially they made him the object of jokesome drollery. Then, after a while, they lost control of themselves and mistreated him to such a degree that they killed him. The report, which makes no mention of miracles occurring at the site of the relics of the martyred child, seems to possess all the indications of truthfulness. Moreover, as we have seen above, there are people who have viewed the immoderate celebrations of Purim, accompanied by anti-Christian insults and violence, as the core from which the belief in Jewish ritual homicide of Christian children is thought to have developed during the Middle Ages, as an integral part of a ritual centered around on the festival of Pesach, considered the ideal culmination of Purim. The case of Iomistar is not an isolated one. A Jewish source, the memoirs of Rabbi Ephraim of Bonn, takes us to France, to Brigant Robert, in 1191 or 1192. A servant of the Duchess of Champagne was found guilty of the murder of a Jew and was being held in prison for that offense. The other Jews of the village decided to rescue the prisoner in exchange for money and executed him during the festival of Purim, hanging him. A perfidious Christian killed a Jew in the city of Brie, which is in France. Then the other Jews, his relatives, went to the lord of the region, the Duchess of Champagne, and implored her to hand over the murderer, who was a servant of the King of France. They therefore bribed her with their money in order to be able to crucify the killer. And they crucified him on the eve of Purim. The vengeance demanded in a loud voice by the Christians of Brie, headed by Philippe II August, King of France, 1165-1223, was not long in coming. The entire adult Jewish population of the city, totaling about 80 persons, were tried and condemned to be burnt at the stake. Wealthy persons, rich and influential, some of them famous rabbis and people of culture, who refuse to sully themselves in the baptismal waters and to betray the one God, were burned alive proclaiming the unity of the Creator. The children, who were Jews and circumcised, were taken en masse to the baptismal font to be the made Christians. No festival of Purim ever concluded in a more tragic manner for the Jews, overturning and thwarting the saving and hope-giving meaning of the biblical account of Esther and Mordecai. The blasphemous parody of the Passion of Christ sometimes had the most tragic consequences. But this obvious fact did not always suffice to cool hot heads and restrain fanatical, agitated minds. The Christians were not too subtle about it, since they certainly didn't need excuses or pretexts to perpetrate indiscriminate massacres of Jews or to plunge Jewish children into the beneficial waters of baptism by force. The spiral of violence, having due regard to the discrepancies between the relative power and size of the two conflicting societies, could not be extinguished. The serpent bit its own tail, leaving its imprint of blood on the sand. Each society was, in a sense, its own victim, but neither noticed. To give a few examples, on the 7th of February 1323, a few days before the festival of Purim, a Jew in the Duchy of Spoleto was condemned for striking and insulting the cross. On the 28th of February 1504, precisely coinciding with the festival of Purim, a beggar from Bivagna accused the local Jews of the place, transformed into evil spirits, of having cruelly crucified him. It was still in the days of Purim, in February 1444, that the Jews of Vigon, in Piedmont, were accused of having pretended to butcher an image of Christ crucified as a joke. Again, it was in the month of February, this time in 1471, that a Jew from Gubbio brought a legal action to scrape the image of the Virgin Mary from the outside wall of his house. Purim was followed by Pesach, but the story, during that violent month, was no different, even without any strict need to play cruel and lethal tricks on Christian boys, or to stone Jews and their houses en masse during the holy hailstorm of stones. On the 21st of March 1456, a Jew of Lodi entered the Cathedral of San Lorenzo at nightfall with a drawn sword, directing himself without hesitation, where he walked straight up to the main altar and proceeded to make log wooden splinters out of the image of Christ crucified, with the evident intention of chopping it to bits. His fate was sealed. The culprit was lynched on the spot, amidst the rejoicing of a jubilant crowd, and vengeance was wreaked. The 21st of March 1456 corresponded to the 15th of the month of Nisan of the Jewish year 5216 and the first day of Pesach. The matter was thus described by the commander of Lodi to the Duke of Milan, in our dear city of Lodi, on the 21st day, 17 hours, of the present month, March, according to the common reports, a Jew entered the cathedral with sword in hand to cut the crucifix of Christ to pieces, for which offense the whole territory rose up against him and they ran to the Jew's house, and killed the above-mentioned Jew and dragged him on the ground. In the early modern age, the carnival-like festivities of Purim finally lost those qualities of aggressiveness and violence which had been characteristic since the early Middle Ages, but never renounced the clearly anti-Christian meaning it possessed according to tradition. Thus wrote Giulio Morosini, known as Shemuel Namias at Venice when he was still a Jew, a shrewd former disciple of Leon de Medina, during the reading of the Megillah of Esther, Whenever Haman is named, the boys beat the benches of the synagogue with hammers or sticks with all their might as a sign of excommunication, crying out in a loud voice, "May his name be blotted out and may the name of the impious rot." And they all cried, "Be cursed, Haman, be blessed, Mordecai, be blessed Esther, be cursed Ahasuerus." And they continue like that until evening, just as on the morning of the first day, never ceasing to express their justified contempt for Haman and the enemies of Judaism at that time, covertly spreading poison against Christians, under the name of idolaters. They therefore cry out in a loud voice, "Be cursed all the idolaters." But at an even earlier time, the illustrious jurist Marquardo Sassani, protected by Paolo IV Carafa, the fervent and impassioned founder of the Ghetto of Rome, mentioned the wild hostility of the Jews towards Christianity as well as the peculiar carnival-like characteristics of Purim. According to him, during the Feast of Mordecai, the Jews did not hesitate to greet each other by saying, in contemptuous tones, "May the King of the Christians go down to ruin immediately, the way Haman went down to ruin."